You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Over the course of her career, Nancy Shepherd Hughes, a professor of anthropology at the University of California, Berkeley, has collected extensive evidence about the underground illegal trade in human organs. It began when she heard rumors that thieves in northeastern Brazil would kill young children in order to sell their body parts on the black market, and she decided to investigate. Ethan Waters has written about Ms. Shepherd Hughes' work and why her colleagues are often less than supportive in an article called The Organ Detective. It's in the July-August issue of Pacific Standard Magazine and brings Ethan Waters to our show. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
How did Nancy Shepherd Hughes first hear about the organ trafficking rumors?
Well, she was down in Brazil working on her book, which was later called Death Without Weeping, and she heard among the local sources that there were these rumors of vans who would pull up and kidnap children, and the children's bodies would later be found sort of eviscerated of their organs in ditches and hospital bins and so forth. Well, Nancy was, she was documenting the impoverishment down there, the death records, the horrible conditions, and she had a great deal of reason to be skeptical of this because she was, keeping track of when bodies would show up and how they were treated and so forth. There was no evidence of this, but she was trying to figure out where these rumors came from, determined that they weren't true, but had this idea that they were sort of true on a metaphorical level, that this was an expression of the local people's maltreatment in other general ways. It was only later, when she was brought to a conference of surgeons in Bellagio, Italy, to explain these rumors, that she began to see a sort of a wider picture of what was actually going on in the organ trade world.
But she mentioned the rumors in her book, Death Without Weeping. What kind of response did that get?
Well, that was sort of a side point in the book, and I think her point that she made, which was that these rumors were true at what she says was a metaphorical level between fact and rumor, is a point that I'm not sure a lot of people quite sort of understood. I'm not exactly sure I fully understand it either. It's a very sort of academic point that they're not true, but they have some truth in them. And these surgeons that asked her to come to the conference were certainly interested in what was true and what was not true. And if they were looking for a very clear explanation of, like, whether the rumors were true around the world or whether they weren't, they likely didn't get it from Nancy. But it was actually at that conference that Nancy began to sort of really get her grounding in terms of what she was going to do with the next 20 years of her research, because she began to talk to these surgeons about and ask them questions about where do these organs come from? Like, how do they get these organs, and to what extent are these organs being purchased? To what extent is there a black market out there? To what extent is the category of brain deadness being exploited? And she realized at that moment that there really was like a tremendous opportunity for her as an anthropologist to begin to study this global trade in human organs. And indeed, there is a global trade in human organs, although those rumors of the kidnap and murder for organs are very likely not true. There certainly are people that are being shipped around the world to donate their kidneys for a profit, being paid for that. And there certainly are a great deal of abuse of dead bodies in morgues all over the world, where dead bodies are being harvested for skin and tissue and corneas and pituitary glands and all sorts without the proper permission from the family or the individual before they died.
Is it illegal if the person is willing to sell his own kidney?
In almost every country in the world, that is illegal. You cannot compensate for a donated kidney. There are exceptions. Iran is an exception. China's policies are a little bit more unclear what they do, but that does go on. Certainly, I think the WHO, the World Health Organization, suggested that of the member countries, of the approximately 100,000 kidney transplants that happened in a given year, approximately 1 in 10 come from the black market in some way. And it's important to note that black market could be someone being paid for their kidneys without the doctor's knowledge, without the hospital knowledge. It could be that the hospital and the doctor were fully complicit in the knowledge that this kidney was being bought But so there's a variety of categories within that sort of black market.
How do organ brokers find people willing to sell their organs? You describe the way some of the sellers see the sale as almost spiritual.
Well, at times, you know, when Nancy documented when she went down to the Philippines, so she's documented organ donors in the Philippines and Moldova and Eastern Europe and South Africa and Brazil. And she's discovered really interesting nuances around the world about how people perceive that donation. And indeed, in some people in the Philippines, she found some people comparing it to, you know, the scar you get from the donation to the lance wound that Christ received on the cross. And they talk about it as a great way they sacrifice for their family, their family's well-being. They've done this thing. Indeed, in other places, in Moldova, for instance, people, you know, who have gotten donated kidneys are considered to be next to invalids, that they are completely lost their manhood, they're ostracized from the community, they're treated very poorly. So around the world, you have different conceptions of how it goes. And indeed, as you mentioned, there are these organ brokers who go out and you know, offer money to people in difficult situations to do things like fly from Brazil to a transplant center in South Africa, where a donor will come from the United States or Israel, for example, and you have the sort of international sort of meeting in a hospital in South Africa where the kidney transplant will take place.
And the doctors who are performing the surgery are real doctors? Is this totally safe?
No, this happens at the top transplant units in the world, and that includes the United States. Now, it's critical to note that doesn't necessarily mean that the doctor, the transplant surgeon, the guy that stands there over the body and does the transplant, was fully knowledgeable about the fact that down the line that there was money paid to the kidney donor. Oftentimes, these brokers go to great lengths to hide the fact that this is not a altruistic donation, that these guys aren't cousins. You know, they present these guys as cousins, or they present these guys as good friends. The fact that they don't speak, you know, the same language might, you know, should have sent up some flags maybe. But oftentimes, so the doctors either might have been taken in by the broker and the relationship that was presented to them. They might also, in many cases, just turn a blind eye to it. They don't want to know. They say, you know, they just want to see the patients on the table. That's their job. They don't think of it. The other part is their job. They just turn a blind eye.
And that's what's
when
made.
They should know.
That's what's made Ms. Shepherd Hughes such a controversial figure.
Yes, I think so. Within the medical community, she doesn't see much of a distinction there, like the doctors that turn a blind eye versus the doctors that are fully complicit in a black market. She doesn't see much of a distinction, and she thinks indeed that the transplant community, and she compares them to the way that the, you know, Catholic Church has dealt in the past with child abusing priests. She says, like, these doctors are protected by a transplant hierarchy that doesn't, you know, wants to deny that this is happening. And so that makes, you know, statements like that, of course, make her a deeply controversial figure within the world of the transplant surgeons.
Ethan Waters has written an article about Dr. Shepherd? Is she a professor?
She's a professor, yeah.
Professor Shepherd Hughes' work in an article called The Organ Detective. It's in the July-August issue of the Pacific Standard magazine. You say that this has led to a new kind of anthropology?
Well, she, back even before she started this, her trip down the organ, into the organ world, she asked for something called she wanted to change anthropology into sort of a militant anthropology. She is certainly a very left-wing, radical, somewhat professor, and she suggested that anthropologists should become basically class traitors to their own class, and that they should, you know, sort of, you know, be not only advocates of the people that they that are their sources, but they should join in arms, you know, politically speaking, with the people that they report about. And this was during a time when anthropology really had a sort of an identity crisis. You know, back in the 50s, if you were an anthropologist, you would go out into the field with this sort of manual of facts you were to collect about your, you know, this exotic culture you were going into. Everyone was collecting the same sort of set of facts. It was a discipline that tried to be scientific and objective. Then along came the 60s and 70s, and you had a whole group of scholars kind of rejecting that notion of anthropology, that that was just imperialism in another guise, or worse, you know, a pretext for violence and oppression. And so, you know, Nancy's idea was that the anthropologist really should be this sort of political advocate, as well as collecting the facts, but also a political advocate for the sources that the places they went into. And of course, the old school anthropologist saw great danger for the discipline in that turn of events. But Nancy certainly, you know, went full steam, and I think she's still, you know, in a way, that same militant anthropologist she declared she was going to be in the early 90s.
So is some of the criticism not just because people disagree with her take on organ trading, but also just on who she is and what she represents?
It's who she is and also how she presents her information. I mean, she
could she be a bit abrasive?
Oh, she is a firebrand. I mean, in this sort of remarkable way. One is she's, you know, certainly one of the bravest people I've ever met. She will, but the way she presents her information, it's often exceedingly inflammatory. I mean, she publishes in the best academic journals, but she also publishes screeds and things like Counterpunch and other places where she just really lets loose on people. And some of her fellow scholars, and certainly some of the people she's worked with within the transplant community, begin to back away from her at that point, saying, you know, this doesn't look like scholarship. This doesn't look like the sort of scholarship that I understand. And one of her early collaborators in the organization she founded called Organs Watch, one of the fellow founders, David Rothman, who works at Columbia University, broke ties with Nancy very early on in their collaboration, saying what she does is just simply not the sort of scholarship that I recognize.
She had teamed up with David Rothman and his wife Sheila, along with Lawrence Cohn, after the Bellagio conference. How did they split up the research?
Oh, that was interesting. Yeah. Cohen had expertise in India, so he wrote about organ trades in India. Rothman sort of was already writing about China and took the China. Nancy, being an expert in Brazil and South America, went back to those places. So they sort of split up the world a little bit. Then they got back together a couple years later. I find it very ironic that it was in Tokyo at a Starbucks. To found Organs Watch, and that the idea was this would be a repository for how organs were being traded and used around the world, a way to track the black market organ trade. But that collaboration was really only lasted basically until Rothman came out to see what Nancy, for the opening of Organs Watch, and saw the website, and Rothman thought, well, this was, you know, it was all pictures of dead bodies and very inflammatory language. And Rothman said, I can't be part of it. You know, I can't be part of this because this is not the sort of scholarship that I recognize.
We're going to take a little break. We'll be back with more from Ethan Waters, who has written about Professor Shepherd Hughes' work in an article called The Organ Detective. It's in the July-August issue of Pacific Standard Magazine. Stay with us for more. We are back with Ethan Waters, whose article, The Organ Detective, is in the July-August issue of Pacific Standard Magazine. A listener called in to say that when you donate an organ, even if it's for your mother, a lot of various doctors and social workers and psychologists ask you many times what it's for, why you're doing it, and what the circumstances are, probably to determine if people are being coerced or paid. So there are some safeguards in place, aren't there?
Absolutely. There are people that's their job is to make sure that these things are going well. Now, and so the question becomes a number of questions. One is, as I said, organ brokers often coach their donors and their recipients, the pairs that they put together, to pass those tests, basically, to have a believable story to tell these people. There's also the question in some institutions of how much pressure that person has, or how much power that social worker has to sort of call a halt to an operation, whether they actually feel the power within that organization to do that, or whether they're just, you know, their job is just to fill out these forms so that the transplant can go on. Obviously, transplants, are very expensive, and they're a great deal of income for hospitals, especially these ones that the brokers bring to the hospitals, because they're often basically cash transactions. It's not insurance. This is not, you know, this is a matter of a broker saying, I got this guy from Israel. I got this guy from Moldova. We're going to pay you the going rate for this transplant. And whether that social worker has the power to sort of call off a transplant that's going to net the hospital, you know, tens of thousands of dollars is really an open question. You would find a different answer in different institutions.
You mentioned that David Rothman was an expert on China, and he believed that the organ trafficking trade might be connected to the anti-crime campaign in China. The organs of criminals could be harvested after their death, which brings up the ethical question, do people have a right to their own body after their death?
Right, and I think, you know, in general, I think the answer to that is absolutely they do, and if they don't, the first-degree family members who get to decide, you know, how a body is disposed of certainly should have the rights. And indeed, most of the abuses are, you know, in terms of sheer numbers, I think most of the abuses actually happen in the pathology centers to those dead bodies around the world, that they're often harvested for corneas and tissues. Now, these aren't the livers, hearts, and lungs that need really a live body to do the at the very end, to have a body still pumping blood to keep those organs viable. But there are a variety of tissues that the human body can, that are useful after death. And indeed, in morgues around the world, there's a great deal of abuse that goes on in terms of how those tissues are being used.
Wasn't there a scandal about Alistair Cook's bones being stolen?
Indeed. Nancy has written about that Alistair Cook's body was indeed also unfortunately used in various ways without the family's permission.
So he had bone cancer.
Right. If it can happen to Alistair Cook, it's certainly happening around the world in different places.
What happened after Nancy published her first major article on the organ trade in the April 2000 issue of Current Anthropology?
Well, it was a very interesting reaction. It was a very widely publicized piece. It was a big deal. A lot of anthropologists said this is like a vindication of modern anthropology. This is, you know, anthropology has spent the last 10 years staring at its own navel, and now Nancy has shown us the way to go. This is what we need to do. Other anthropologists were very skeptical about the sort of wide-ranging nature of the piece she did. It took examples from, you know, Russia and Brazil and everywhere, and they thought it was too skimmed over the top. It sounded to them sort of like muckraking journalism, and other people were very unimpressed. But it was certainly a very big article within the world of anthropology, and the reaction was decidedly mixed about it.
Her style is not typical of the way that anthropologists in the field write, and she's also been accused of questionable practices and pushing the ethical boundaries of anthropological research.
Well, not just accused of that. I mean, this is something she fully admits to, and it's to her credit that within these articles where she describes her own practices, she's bringing up these issues herself. She's saying, look, I am pushing the ethical limits of anthropology, and just to name a couple of them, one is that she often, you know, she will do things like walk into a hospital and sort of begin to interview, the staff, saying, I'm Dr. Shepherd Hughes, I need to know this information. She won't identify herself as an anthropologist. She won't identify the research she's doing. And most anthropologists would say you really have to have an agreement with sources. They need to understand what's at stake. They need to understand who you are. Nancy says, you know, in this situation, I'm going to allow myself to go undercover. She goes to places and she says, I'm looking for a kidney for my husband, or I'm seeking a kidney for myself. She negotiates prices with donors before she reveals the fact that, you know, she's an anthropologist. So she does a number of things. And the other thing that other anthropologists have a great deal of trouble with is she has taken a lot of her research and taken it straight to law enforcement, to the FBI, to Interpol, and to a variety of law enforcement agencies, both in the United States and around the world. And she says, look, I'm looking into this crime. I have no choice but not to do this, while other anthropologists would say you have this contract with your sources not to sort of take information from them and then turn around and potentially get them into legal hot water by sharing it with an FBI or with a Interpol agency.
Wasn't she connected to the political corruption and money laundering scheme in New Jersey a few years ago as one of the people who revealed what was going on, especially involving a man named Levi Yitzchak Rosenbaum?
Right. So she was way ahead of that. So Isaac Rosenbaum was one of the brokers that brought pairs of donor recipient pairs to major hospitals in the United States, presented these pairs to the hospitals, got the transplants done, and he was paying off the donors, certainly, possibly paying off other people in the system, and he was the first prosecution that was done for organ trafficking within the United States. Nancy was 8 years ahead of the FBI on this story. She was trying to, you know, in 2002 and 2003, she was desperately trying to share this information with the FBI, had meetings with them, gave them information. Nothing happened until years later when Rosenbaum happened to be swept up in that large corruption scandal in New Jersey where 100 people were sort of arrested on the same day. Rosenbaum was one of them. And then suddenly the prosecutors did indeed want Nancy's help and utilize Nancy's research in that case. And Rosenbaum ended up pleading guilty to organ trafficking, and is now serving 2.5 years in prison for it.
How did the South African law enforcement react to what she was saying?
Well, it's a great contrast, because the United States, I don't think people knew what to make of this, and it certainly didn't make the headlines. When a similar thing was discovered in South Africa, and this was a scheme where Brazilian kids were being taken to South Africa and Israeli recipients were coming down and getting paid for kidney transplants. When that was discovered in South Africa, it was an enormous story. It was a front page news, and indeed they brought in Nancy as one of their sort of resources and investigators. She worked very closely with the South African police to give them an idea of what was going on in Brazil, how these kids were getting there, who was involved with the trafficking in Brazil, and giving them a sense of how this was going on around the world. So, you know, the police in South Africa embraced Nancy with open arms. The police in, you know, the law enforcement in the United States seemed to sort of want to basically back out of the room, not knowing what to make of this militant anthropologist they had on their hands.
And then, of course, wound up with a great photo op when they finally decided to arrest these people. My guest is Ethan Waters, who's written an article called The Oregon Detective. It's in the July-August issue of Pacific Standard magazine. We have a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. This is WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Gedalia Gadi-Tauber is a kidney broker who Shepherd Hughes interviewed many times. What did he tell her?
Oh, he gave her this is an excellent example of how Nancy sort of is able to get interviews with really the key players in the organ world. And he was already in jail in Brazil, and he told her of, you know, basically the whole scheme of how he would pay local Brazil kids $10,000 if they would give their kidneys. So then he would ship them to South Africa where they would do the transplant. These kids would come back with, a big wad of cash. And suddenly, as Gadi said, that he had more donors than he knew what to do with. And, of course, he's one of these people in the system that thinks he's done nothing wrong. He's only helped people, both the donors and the recipients. Nancy's research really did reveal that world of how it actually went down there in Brazil.
A listener, Amy in Manhattan, asks, how does a potential organ recipient know if the organ was obtained legitimately, and would it be safe if it weren't?
Well, they know that usually because they're paying for it. I mean, it is ultimately the recipient who has to lay out the cash to pay for the broker and for the donor to get the money. It's the money comes from them, right? So the recipient is almost always in on the deal. They know what is happening. Otherwise, you know, I think you do know that the source of these of the organs, whether you're doing this legitimately or not.
You accompanied Nancy on a visit with a retired transplant surgeon. What was that experience like?
Right. So Nancy got one of the surgeons finally decided to talk to her, and this is from a major East Coast hospital. And we went and met him in Philadelphia.
And you haven't named him in the article. Is there any reason?
I did not name him in the article. There wasn't a, you know, we did not have an agreement with him to keep his name private. But I felt it just in the end of the day, like the editors at Pacific Standard and I felt that there was nothing truly to be gained by naming him. He was a retired surgeon. He was, you know, came out and gave us this information, you know, allowed us to tape this interview he had with Nancy. And I just felt that there was nothing really to be gained by naming him publicly. But there was no agreement up front we had with him. He was very open and honest. But he was open and honest, and he said basically what a lot of surgeons around the world say to Nancy, which is like, hey, look, I'm not a policeman. You know, I'm the surgeon. I do this procedure, but I don't really need to know, or I don't really, you know, no one really tells me whether this is, you know, a legitimate thing. He said he suspected that there might be payment going on, and this is actually the guy that's critical to know. This is one of the guys that did the Rosenbaum transplant. So he knew Isaac Rosenbaum. He knew that those transplants had been set up by him, but he claims not to know that there was money involved. And he says, you know, I'm not a cop. I'm a surgeon. You know, there are other people involved in the hospital. They're supposed to track these things. But at the end, Nancy got him to admit, basically, that something really did seem fishy about these transplants. It seemed weird that these people had come from two different countries, and, you know, there was this altruistic donation going on. Although he says at the end of the day, he says, look, I saved lives. No one got hurt. And when he said that, Nancy really did sort of get upset with him, saying, basically, you actually don't know how the donor did. The donor goes back to their poor country. There's no follow-up care. You don't know what's happened to them. So you cannot say, like, everyone was fine, because you actually don't know what happened to that donor.
What percentage of transplanted organs come from the black market?
The World Health Organization figures it's about 10% at this point.
And the rest are legitimately obtained from people who have donated their organs?
Right. So either donated or the brain dead donors are the other source of this. People, you know, you put your little sticker on your driver's license, and if you ever are in the unfortunate situation of being brain dead and you're an organ donor, the organ can come from there as well. And with kidneys, it's a lot of family and friends who are good matches that donate to a person that needs a kidney.
She's not the only one who's made these kinds of accusations. There was a Swedish article by Donald Bostrom about people being murdered for their body parts that caused an international rift. And she came to his defense after there was a big uproar?
So Bostrom wrote an article basically repeating the claims of Palestinian families that suggested that their sons had been killed in conflict with Israel, taken off the battlefield while still alive, and harvested for their major organs. Now, of course, it's an incredibly incendiary thing, charges to publish. Bostrom published these charges. There was a massive reaction from Israel. The Prime Minister of Israel denounced the article. There was boycotts on Swedish products. It was a big deal. And about a year later, Nancy came to Bostrom's defense, saying that she had an interview from 2000 with an Israeli pathologist who said to her that he had indeed taken tissues off of dead bodies, both Palestinian, Israeli, anyone that came across his table. Basically, he was operating under this sort of notion of presumed consent, which is like, he sees a dead body, he thinks there's useful tissue, there's corneas, there's skin to be had. He just used dead bodies any way he wanted to.
But whether that's unethical or not, it's not the same thing as harvesting only the bodies of Palestinians.
Right. So it is deeply unethical, but it is dramatically different than the charges repeated in the Bostrom article. There is a huge difference between someone being taken off the battlefield while still alive and have their hearts and kidneys used for transplant, than a pathologist who sees a dead body on his table and takes skin and cornea. What that pathologist did was entirely unethical. Nancy was critical in getting him removed from his job. The main whistleblower at the at the Institute was actually became the director of the Institute now. So in many ways, the outcome that Nancy's had in this case has been entirely for the good. However, she does seem to sort of lump things together. She lumps together those claims of the Palestinian families with what this unethical pathologist was doing. And, you know, certainly some people in the anthropology world criticize Nancy for not sort of having a finer line and splitting these things apart between, you know, sort of the gray areas of what's going on here. Certainly what Hiss did with the dead bodies that came across his table in Israel was absolutely unacceptable and unforgivable. But it is dramatically different than what the charges in the Bostrom article. I see, you know, almost in an entirely different world to me. But Nancy sees them as very much similar, and she thinks that the Hiss tape that she had is sort of the smoking gun for the Bostrom article. And indeed, I think that's entirely fanciful.
Ethan, we have very little time left, but I just wanted to touch on one other thing. You attended the Isaac Rosenbaum sentencing hearing with Nancy. And she disapproved of the proceedings. Why?
Oh, it was really a remarkable moment. So there was testimony by a doctor from Albert Einstein Hospital. There was testimony from the family member of the person who had set up the transplant. There was testimony by the donor himself, the man who had gotten paid. And as I sat there with Nancy in the courtroom, she really sort of had a disparaging thing to say about each and every one of the people involved, including the prosecution, including the defense. And at one point, she had said that she thought that the role of the anthropologist, medical anthropologist, was to become sort of a court jester, that is, a mocking and dissenting voice from the sidelines. And it occurred to me at that moment that she'd almost literally become that exact court jester, you know, for my own benefit at that moment. But she's, you know, really a very contentious and remarkable and courageous woman at the end of the day.
We have a link to Ethan Waters' article called The Oregon Detective. It's in the July-August issue of Pacific Standard Magazine. You can find it there, or you can find it on our show page at wnyc.org. Ethan, thank you so much for being on our show today.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.